Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Thank you for joining us in this, the latest of the OI's podcast series. My name is David Ledesma, and I'm Distinguished Research Fellow at the Institute. I'm today joined by Bassam Fatou, Director, and Andreas Economou, who's Head of the Oil Programme at the OIS. And we're here today to discuss the current state of the oil markets in this, the last OIS podcast of 2022, titled Oil Markets in Flux as Uncertainties Abound. Just to timestamp this recording, we are doing it on the afternoon of Friday, the 16th of December, 2022. Bassam and Andreas, welcome to the OIS podcast series.
Thank you, David, for having me.
Good to be with you, David.
Well, Bassam, you know, can I perhaps come to you first? You know, how do you see the current state of the oil market?
Well, one can describe the oil market really with few words. Volatility, extreme uncertainty, and very disconnected narratives. So on the one hand, there is the bullish micro oil narrative, which based on the expectation of big Russian supply losses as the EU embargo on Russian crude imports came into force on December the 5th. Also, the buffers in the system in the shape of spare capacity and inventories remain relatively low. Observed global stocks have remained fairly flat, and OECD stocks are well below the five-year average, particularly for products such as middle distillates, though there has been some build in OECD stocks recently. But more generally, David, this bullish narrative is based on the concept that there isn't enough investment flowing into the oil sector, and this will eventually have an impact on future supplies and productive capacity. But at the same time, there's also the bearish macro narrative, which is related to global recessionary fears, tightening monetary policy by central banks to combat inflation, and China's zero COVID policy. Although China has been recently dismantling its zero COVID rules, but the recovery in oil demand will most likely be bumpy as infections rise and health systems come under pressure. So all of these factors have had an adverse impact on oil demand and balances. At the start of the year, the consensus estimate for oil demand growth for 2022 was at around 3.7 million barrels per day. By December, this has been revised closer to 2 million barrels per day. For 2023, oil demand growth was estimated at around 2.3 million barrels per day. Now, this has been revised lower by 600,000 barrels per day by December, and some banks have even revised lower. So, big downward revisions in global oil demand growth. But David, it's quite important to note that growth of 2 million barrels per day in 2022 and 1.6 million barrels per day in 2023, of course, if this materializes, remain big numbers. But for now, the macro bearish narrative is dominating market dynamics and sentiment, and oil prices have been subject to downward pressure in recent weeks. And that downward pressure really has also been reflected in the term structure, in the physical differentials, but also gas oil margins, which at one point reached unprecedented levels a few months ago, but since then have fallen, although they remain elevated by historical standards.
So Andreas, you know, if I can come to you, you know, at the start of the year, you know, many were predicting higher oil prices and much tighter markets. So now what went wrong?
So David, this has to do with the change in expectations, both on the supply and the demand side. And starting with the supply side, at the start of the Russian-Ukraine war and following the April drop of Russian production by nearly 1 million barrels per day, there was a wide belief that we will witness a big disruption of Russian oil supplies as the impact of the sanctions comes into force. In retrospect, the disruption turned out to be much more limited, and by July, Russian production recovered close to 300,000 barrels per day below pre-war levels, around which level it hovered for the remainder of the year. That is well below initial expectations of up to a 3 million barrels per day disruption, David, back in March, April. Essentially, what happened is that Russia succeeded in redirecting crude exports away from Europe and North America to other parts of the world, particularly to Asia, and within Asia to India and China, through offering discounts and easier payment conditions. Services and logistics, such as shipping and insurance, have not acted as constraints. It quickly became clear that the US and the G7 are keen that Russia oil continues to flow and will not use secondary sanctions to cause a supply shock. also outside Russia, the emergency release of strategic stocks by the US and other IEA members managed to ease some of the supply-driven price pressures. On the demand side, over the year, recessionary pressures in the aftermath of the war continued to build, especially in Europe, and by mid-year, central banks began tightening monetary policy. The situation in China, which has been a major engine of oil demand growth in the past years, was also deteriorating due to its strict zero-COVID policy and housing market crisis, leading by our projections to a year-on-year contraction of Chinese demand growth of around 500,000 barrels per day in 2022, and this is for the first time in 3 decades, David. Also, it is worth noting that at the start of the year, there were expectations that some of the rebound effects from COVID will continue into 2022. Particularly, jet fuel demand was expected to rebound near or at its pre-COVID levels as economies open up and people travel more. But again, international travel, particularly to Asia, has not fully recovered and the industry is facing bottlenecks. Ending 22, we estimate that jet fuel demand remains around 20% below its pre-COVID levels. And lastly, mid-year, there were also expectations that there will be a large substitution from gas to oil because of higher gas prices and less gas supplies into Europe, but oil switch has also been minimal.
So, Andreas, you know, does this mean that the Russia-Ukraine war has had limited impact on the oil market so far?
In terms of physical supply-demand balances, I would say that the impact has been limited so far, as the size of disruption from Russia turned out to be small. But in terms of trade flows, the Russia-Ukraine war has had a profound impact as the resilience of Russian supply happened on the back of massive and most likely lasting transformations in crude trade flows. Large volumes of Russian crude exports have been diverted away from Europe to Asia, where Russia is now left with two main clients, China and India, which are now the top buyers of Russian crude. India particularly has been increasing its imports of Russian yields that between January and 2013, when our record starts, to March 22, averaged only around 20,000 barrels per day, and between April and November, averaged nearly 700,000 barrels per day. This has been displacing barrels from the US and West Africa, as well as Middle Eastern barrels, though Middle East suppliers have term contracts and there will be limits on how much barrels from the region will be displaced. The picture in China is slightly different. The incremental intake there has been half than that from India, around 350,000 barrels per day, and mostly accounted by independent refineries. Also, Urals in China have also been competing with Iranian crude. As to Europe, refineries have been filling the Russian gap by importing more crude from West Africa and the US, but also the Middle East, as some of the crude, such as Saudi Arab Light, are preferred as they are similar to Urals and have high diesel yield. And Iraq's high sulfur Basra medium has also proven a good alternative as it is blended to create synthetic crudes. Latin America crudes are also a good alternative to Urals for European refiners, but they could probably play a larger role in 23. And this transformation, David, in trade flows is not only limited to crude, but also to products.
So, Andreas, you mentioned products. Can you perhaps, you know, share with our listeners, you know, what's been happening on the product side of the market?
Well, David, Russia's exports of products have fallen from 3.2 million barrels per day before the war to around 2.9 in November. And this includes gasoline, naphtha, VGO, jet fuel, fuel oil, and even gas oil, but crucially not diesel. The biggest decline has been to the Americas by 500,000 barrels per day, followed by Europe at 300,000, while rerouting of products is mainly directed to Asia, which is up by 300,000 barrels per day. Now, Russian diesel exports to Europe before the war were around 700, and by October they were nearly halved, but in November they rose again near pre-war levels at 700,000 barrels per day and accounted for nearly 40% of total European diesel imports. But overall, Russia's efforts to divert products away from traditional customers have proven to be logistically more difficult than crude in terms of transportation and marketing. The tanker fleet for clean products is not big enough, and product specifications differ considerably across countries. If Russia is not able to divert more products away from Europe, then it may have to cut runs which will free more crude for exports, adding to the challenge of diverting additional amount of Russian crude to other parts of the world. And as Russia exports of products to Europe have fallen, however, EU importers now have to go further away places to secure their imports of petroleum products. Again, imports from the US and the Middle East are filling part of the gap, but the EU is also attracting products imports from China and India. So in short, massive transformation in trade flows, which will only intensify in 2023, especially after February when the EU embargo on Russian products comes into force.
Okay, Bassam, perhaps I can come back to you about kind of post-embargo, because with the embargo coming into effect, you know, do you expect a higher disruption from Russia to materialize?
Well, David, this would depend on multiple factors, but let me try to break them down. First, there is a strong interest from the US to keep Russian oil flowing to avert a supply shock. Actually, you know, one could say that the whole idea behind the price cap is to minimize the impact of the EU embargo on Russian oil export. In terms of logistics, Russia has enough access to tankers to move the displaced crude in Europe to other markets. Russia has its own fleet, and it has been active in securing more tankers in the last few months from what is known as the dark tanker fleet. But in some ports like Kuzmino, there are some reports suggesting that it's proving more difficult to secure tankers after the embargo. The issue of quality of insurance and its coverage could represent a barrier, but most buyers of Russian crude seem to be willing to rely on insurance arrangements outside the G7, including those provided by Russian insurance firms. Of course, those are lower value insurances, but they could keep the trade running, though we need to wait and see whether these alternative forms of insurance are sufficient. Also, Russia has lost most of its clients in Asia, and currently most of its exports to Asia are destined to India and China, as Andrea just mentioned. So there is the question of whether India and China are willing to take additional volumes of Russian crude. But at enough deep discounts and attractive payment conditions, most likely they will take additional volumes, though Indian and Chinese refineries would need to balance the volume of barrels bought under long-term contracts, mainly from the Middle East, and Russian barrels. As Andreas mentioned, India has been more active in increasing its Russian oil imports. China has been more cautious in picking Russian crude, perhaps waiting until the dust settles, but also there are some quality issues with Urals. The biggest challenge facing Russia, and as well as the EU, I would say, will be in February 2023, when the embargo on Russian imports of petroleum products come into effect. As Andreas mentioned, diverting products is much more challenging tasks. And in response, Russia may be forced to cut refinery runs, and this could impact production. Also, a key issue remains whether Russia is willing to retaliate to the embargo and the price cap and cut production unilaterally. In a recent interview, Putin said that Russia may cut production, but that no decision has been made yet. And so far, all the indications are that Russia will not cut output in response to the price cap. So, David, in short, there are a lot of factors in play, and we are assuming a supply loss of around 1.1 million barrels per day in 2023 in our reference model. So to put this in perspective, Russia's crude and condensate production pre-war was at around 11 million barrels per day. In 2023, we're expecting Russia's production to fall to an annual average, which is close to 10 million barrels per day.
Okay, Bassam, you know, that's quite a considerable reduction. But what about the price cap on Russian crude? You know, how effective is it?
Well, the price cap has many problematic features. You know, to start with, many of the operational aspects remain vague and perhaps on purpose. The information and data points needed to verify whether a cargo has been sold at the price cap are very difficult to obtain. And even if they are obtained, it's not clear how this can be checked, as data and documentation can be easily falsified. It's also not that difficult to disguise the origin of the crude. You know, that could happen through blending and ship-to-ship transfers. Also, oil is not priced on a fixed level, but rather on the basis of benchmarks and differentials to benchmarks. And also, the pricing period could be a few weeks ahead, and it will be difficult for buyers to know the price at the time of purchase or loading. There's also the question on whom this cap applies to. In countries that have announced that they don't want to import Russian crude, the price cap mechanism will not be used, and therefore the price cap is irrelevant to them. And those countries that continue to import Russian crude, they said that they will not adhere to the price cap mechanism. So think, for instance, India, China, and Turkey. Some argue that for countries not adhering to the cap, the mechanism gives them the advantage to negotiate lower prices. I'm not sure about this. At the end of the day, bargaining power and pricing depends on whether one is in a buyer's or a seller's market, regardless of the existence of the price cap mechanism.
So, but Sam, how do you kind of think Russia will respond to the price cap? You know, will it cut output in response?
This is not yet clear. In weak market conditions, and if Russia wants to continue to sell its crude, they would have to offer large discounts, which most likely will drive the price below the cap. In this case, the price cap doesn't really matter. Russia is already selling its Urals in Asia at a huge discount and well below the price cap of $60 per barrel. Espo crude is currently above the cap, but this is being mainly sold in Asia to countries that announced they will not be applying the price cap mechanism. And in any case, these grades can be traded in the shadow market through blending and ship-to-ship transfers. Now, if Russia is unhappy about the large discount it's offering on its crude, then it can cut its output. And if the cut is deep enough and market becomes tighter, then Russia can command a higher price for its crude and even put a floor on the price. And if the market tightens enough, it can decide how to ration its barrels if there isn't enough crude to go around. Russian barrels in this case would be much in demand as they are likely to be the cheapest in the market. Under these circumstances, Russian barrels may start selling above the cap. This again does not matter much as the main customer for these barrels said that they will not adhere to the price cap mechanism in any case. But so far, as I mentioned before, Russia seems keen to market its crude, and the price reaction in recent days seems to suggest that few believe Russia will cut output unilaterally. But, David, the price cap does create uncertainty and confusion for physical markets. The shippers, insurance, traders, banks, and even financial players may decide to stay outside the market because of the increased uncertainty, and this in turn impacts physical operations and financial operations through reduced liquidity and increased cost of hedging.
So how do you see, therefore, the future for Russia within OPEC Plus?
Well, it depends on which time horizon you take. In the short term, all indicators are that Russia is keen to keep the relationship with OPEC. Also, from OPEC perspective, it took years to build this relationship. And OPEC would also like to maintain the current framework, which now has been extended until the end of 2023. In the medium to longer term, however, Russia's position within OPEC Plus will weaken, for the simple fact that due to sanctions, it will not be able to increase or may even witness a decline in their productive capacity. And the fact that all Western service companies have left Russia, and as Russia starts losing access to high-quality equipment, it's just a matter of time before production starts declining. So Russia most likely will become one of those countries that have a high quota under the OPEC Plus agreement, but not able to meet its target. Already in November, and despite the downward adjustment in OPEC Plus output targets, Russia's production was close to 700,000 barrels per day below its quota. This is in contrast to the key Gulf producers within OPEC, which have solid plans to increase their productive capacity, particularly Saudi Arabia and the UAE. And I would say that this will certainly alter the power dynamics within OPEC Plus in favor of the Gulf producers.
Now, since you mentioned OPEC, you know, were you surprised by OPEC Plus's decision to cut output back in October by 2 million barrels per day? Were you surprised?
Not really. You know, OPEC's decision in October to cut is very much consistent with past behavior. For instance, in 2008 and in face of the global financial crisis, OPEC responded by implementing very deep cuts as global oil demand took a hit. But this time, perhaps it's different in one important aspect. OPEC decided to act preemptively and in a timely manner and not wait until the weak signals on the global economy take their toll on the oil market. And despite all the talk that the decision was politically motivated and that this move endangered the global economy, the decision proved to be the correct one in retrospect. The reality is that since the cut, the demand outlook continued to deteriorate, so has sentiment. Now, in the past, David, such preemptive and proactive moves were not feasible as the cohesion within OPEC was not strong, and it took months to negotiate output cuts. And as a result, OPEC responses always arrived quite late after market balances have weakened sharply. But one need to recognize that the dynamics within OPEC Plus have now changed, and OPEC can respond in a more timely manner. And under the leadership of Saudi Arabia, the cohesion within OPEC Plus is much stronger, and its ability to assess trends and respond has dramatically improved. I would also add that many member countries are producing at maximum capacity and below their quotas, which implied that most of OPEC Plus producers did not have to cut real barrels, but paper barrels from unmet quotas, which basically meant that reaching a decision was much easier. Now, as to the December decision to roll over, I think it was widely expected. There are so many uncertainties engulfing the market, and it makes sense to get some visibility, at least on a couple of issues, China's opening and the impact of the embargo and the price cap on Russian supplies, before basically they take the next move.
Well, interestingly, you mentioned kind of the future there and what the impact of kind of China, could be. And so perhaps, Andreas, I can come to you, because looking forward, what are your models showing in terms of balances and prices for the next year?
So for 2023, David, our reference case sees the Brent price declining to the mid to high 80s in the first half and then starting to recover from May onwards in the 90s and conditional to supportive supply-demand conditions breaking above $100 per barrel in the last quarter. This, however, assumes falling Russian supplies up to 1.1 million barrels per day for the year as a whole, that a deeper recession is avoided, no change in OPEC Plus output policy in the year, and that the Iranian nuclear deal won't be revived. With this in mind, our reference balances show surpluses persisting in the next two quarters before they turn into deficits in the second half of the year, mainly due to unexpected reopening of the Chinese economy that could boost demand. So the year as a whole for now appears to be balanced, posting a small surplus. But part of the modeling approach in our analysis is to consider a wide range of scenarios and stress test the outlook both in terms of prices and balances. So downside risks considered on the demand side are a deeper and more protracted global recession, a persistently elevated inflation, and a delayed recovery of the Chinese economy, while on the supply side, they could stem mainly from a lower realization of Russian supply disruptions after the EU embargo is in full force, US shale growth overshooting expectations, and a breakthrough in the Iranian nuclear deal negotiations. On the other hand, the upside risks considered are related mainly to high Russian supply disruptions, although in our scenarios they do not exceed 1.5 million barrels per day for the year as a whole, renewed geopolitical tensions outside Russia, for example, in Libya, and a faster than expected reopening of China from the first half of 2023 and an early easing of monetary policy. So overall, our balance of risks is skewed on the downside, with demand-side pressures dominating, while supply risks remain relatively limited. In terms of our price outlook, and considering that our reference forecast for 23 stands at $92 per barrel, the Brent price band ranges between $76 and $104 per barrel, with a price floor at $70 and a price ceiling at $118 per barrel on a monthly basis. And the reason, David, why prices remain supported in the lower range scenarios is that the market remains tight in terms of stocks. And although we are building stocks, these are not seen clearing above their five-year average. Also, in our scenarios, we consider that there will be at least a minimum of 700,000 barrels per day disruption in Russian supplies. While if there is no material disruption in Russian supplies from current levels, we do see prices falling in the 60s under our bearish demand scenarios. Market uncertainty related to supply-demand balances remains elevated throughout the year, and particularly the first half of 23, but overall the balance of risks favors weaker supply-demand conditions than our reference case. So all in all, another turbulent year ahead featuring heightened uncertainty and again, many moving parts that they could unsettle the market towards any direction.
Well, look, Bassam, perhaps, we can end this podcast by me coming to you to ask kind of about the kind of the future, the long-term outlook for the oil market. Now, how do you see the evolution of the oil market in the current era of heightened insecurity and uncertainty? Do you think the recent events have caused a kind of long-term transformation in the oil market?
Well, David, energy markets have really been subject to extreme shocks in the past year. And also the uncertainty has been so wide. Of course, oil markets are not strange to shocks, and in the past they have been subject to many of these. You know, you could think of wars, sanctions, weather-related outages. But I would say this time it's different because the potential size of the shocks or potential shocks and much of the uncertainty is induced by decisions that politicians and policymakers are making, and the impact of these decisions on oil markets can be large. We see much more government intervention in energy markets. We see this in electricity and gas markets, but also in oil. Oil has been different than other energy vectors. You know, it's a global market, it's very mature, and oil is a very fungible commodity. But nevertheless, we have seen huge interventions. You know, think of the use of strategic petroleum reserves by the U.S. to control prices on the upside, the imposition of the price cap on Russian imports, the use of embargo and sanctions, you know, potential responses of Russia to the price caps and embargoes. All of these are creating a lot of uncertainty, and it's making the exposure to energy commodities in general less attractive. Also, the shift of sales of Russian crudes from US dollars to other currencies, and whether this would extend to different countries, that's something, you know, one should also continue to monitor. And as Andreas mentioned, we are also seeing massive transformations in oil trade flows. And in that sense, the markets are doing their job in redirecting crude and products. But at the same time, this massive shift in trade flows is having implications on the efficient functioning of the market and the ability of the players to optimize their operations. Now, how big these inefficiencies and the cost of sub-optimization on consumers and players? Perhaps we will never know the answer to that question. Also, when it comes to oil supply, we tended to think about the big three suppliers and their interactions. Here I mean Russia, the US, and the Gulf. The relationships between these three players have changed and will continue to change looking forward. Now, what are the implications of this, and will this have big impacts on oil markets? I think these are all very interesting questions which are worth exploring.
Well, Bassam and Andreas, you know, thank you so much for such a fascinating discussion today. And indeed, you know, we certainly look forward to hearing more about the oil market from the OIS as we carry out our research in papers, in webinars and in podcasts during 2023. I hope you've all enjoyed listening to this podcast. Thank you and goodbye to everyone.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as our original research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our energy transition, gas, oil, electricity, or China research programs, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.